that Francis would get away and go to the caves and the hermitage and the cartery to be able to be quiet and to be still and just kind of figure things out. And yet we live in a world that we never do that. We live in a world that's so busy, we never take the time to figure out what's going on. I mean, how is it that we've got here? What is the situation that we find ourselves in? How is it that the world has changed? What does it mean that we've lived in a post-Christian culture? I think Pope Francis speaks beautifully. He says that we hear the story of the sheep in the Gospels where one leaves and the shepherd goes and looks for the one sheep, and he says, the world we live in today, 99 have left. Mm. Right? 99 sheep have wandered away. And we have one that's remaining. I lived in Austria for a number of years, profoundly Catholic country, 89% Catholic, and 3% of the people go to church on a regular basis. All right, we all have the images many weeks, I guess it would be months ago now, right, of people dancing and celebrating in the streets of Ireland because abortion is now legal. I mean, this is unconscionable. That especially those of you who are older than I, you could not imagine 50 years ago, right, Ireland dancing and rejoicing in the streets because now we get to have abortion. The world is profoundly different. If we take a moment and just think, well, let's do this just to give you an image, okay? Everybody stand up. You represent by standing up, and this is just an image for young people, right? Everybody, all the Catholic kids that are going to church every week, okay? They're high school seniors, all right? All right, if you were born January or February, sit down. Look around, a few less. If you were born March or April, sit down. A few less. June, July, August, September, and before October 22nd. Okay, this is what you see standing right now. 5 years after kids graduated from high school, these are kids that were going to church 5 years after they graduated from high school, this is the number of kids that are still going to be going to church. 75% of, go ahead, everybody can sit down. 75% of kids who graduate from high school, involved with church, going to mass, this is across the board, Catholic, Protestant, within 5 years of graduating from high school, getting out, quote unquote, into the world, into college, 75% of the kids are not going to be going to church in 5 years. Why? What's going on? What is this profound change that's taking place that seems that it's almost impossible for young people to live their faith today? Now, one of the things that I want to be clear is that it might be, well, this is the young people, this is not necessarily a real young people group, right? I don't know how old this is.
Brutal.
But then here's the point is this is a cultural issue. It's a cultural issue. If we think that it's not impacting everybody, it's impacting everybody. This is a cultural issue. Our fellow Franciscan Bishop Chaput would say in the coming years, and I think this is true, more and more Catholics will find it profoundly difficult to live their Catholic faith in the culture that we live in. So, how do we get to this point? Let's just take a moment or two taking a look at worldviews. And these are the worldviews that we hear, that we recognize, that how we find our values, things are important to us. And we've all heard the term postmodern. Pope Benedict chose to use the term post-Christian. And most of the people who write about this speak of a postmodern world that we live in. But how is this? This postmodern world is a worldview. What marks this? So we take a step back. From the beginning of time until the 1500s, we lived in what we call a pre-modern world. In that pre-modern world, supernatural controls all things. God is the starting point of discussion. God motivates. God directs. If we think of art, if we think of science, if we think of technology, it's all about discovering the relationship with God. Art is all of it. If you go to museums in this time, all of the art is religious art. The world is imbued with God, with grace, with the divine, with the supernatural. Art and music are intended to bring forth the glory of God. Truth is rooted in God. Truth can be known. And there is some things that are true and some things that are not true. It can be known, and it is objective. The truth is rooted in God, and it comes to be known because God shares that truth with us. So roughly from the 1600s to the mid-1960s, we find the worldview as a modern worldview, the time of enlightenment, the time of the age of reason. If in the pre-modern world, God is in the center of all that is, in the modern world, man is at the center of all things. It's not that God isn't there, it's just that he doesn't need to be in the middle of things. And this, I think, would be for Francis. Francis's understanding of sin was just that he pushed God off to the side. He pushed God off to the side, and he placed himself in the middle. And this would be characteristics of the modern age. God might exist, but he no longer has an intimate contact with the world. Men and women can discover truth, but they discover truth within themselves. And we see this beginning, this slow separation between God and man. Humanity, we have the ability to make things better because we're really smart. And we can do pretty amazing things. The mind becomes rational. The mind becomes king. If humanity puts their mind to it, they can fix the world's problems. Truth is determined by a given society, by a cultural society. We're going to come to know truth no longer because God is going to reveal that to us, but that society is going to begin to determine what is truth. There is still truth. Some things are right and some things are still wrong. But it's at the discretion of humanity. Right and wrong are no longer based on the character of God, but on human ration, human reason. So we find this going up until the mid-1960s when the humanity is confronted with a major problem. If we think that we can make things better, we can fix it. I mean, if we think of what took place in the early part of the last century with technology, I mean, my grandpa was born in 1912 and died in 1999, I think. I mean, the changes he saw, I mean, even some people in here in this room, right? The changes that we've seen in the last 100 years, they're just simply remarkable. The technology is amazing, and the things that we've been able to do is amazing, but the problem that we saw within reason and within faith life and the worldview is that humanity was supposed to make things better, and yet we find in the first 50 years of the last century, the bloodiest century in human history. Right? So we've got World War I, the war to end all wars, and then we've got the next one, right, where millions and millions of people massacred. This becomes this, again, as a culture, as a worldview, that the humanity is supposed to be able to make things better. If we just put our minds to it, that we can create a better society. Well, this just falls apart in the last century. So again, these dates are all depending who you're reading or who you're working with, but in the mid-1960s, we begin to move from a modern world to a postmodern world. That if in the modern world God is in the center, in the pre-modern world God is in the center, if in the modern world man is in the center, in the post-modern world there is no center. It's just a word that most post-modernists would use that are able to critique the post-modern world is chaos. In the modern world, there could be truth that could be known because society could determine and give to humanity some things that were true and some things that were good and some things that were beautiful. In the postmodern world, the individual determines that. Truth is merely what an individual believes to be true. To think of worlds that are words that define chaos, conflict, confusion. We live in a world, particularly again, and I think it's the young people that suffer most in this, with no boundaries. And here is a conflict that exists with the world today is that we live in a world that says boundaries are not good. You should be able to do whatever you want, whenever you want. This is the world of absolute freedom. And yet, the human person craves boundaries, right? So one of the, I think, interesting studies that they did was at a schoolyard of kids playing. And it was next to a busy street, and one of the during the times of the studies, there was no fence, and I don't know the exact numbers, but the kids would play 10 feet away from the street, all right? Then the next study, they had the same similar situation, except this time there was a fence right next to the street, right? And the kids would play 2 inches from that. But there was something about not having that fence there that they didn't feel safe, so they stayed much further away than they even needed to be. But once that boundary was there, that they could use all of the space that was there available. And yet we live in a world where young people have no boundaries, where God is not a part of our equation, where at the beginning in the pre-modern world, God was the source of goodness and beauty and truth, and that in the modern world, God was there, but he wasn't necessarily intervening in our life, and truth could be known only because man could come to that. We live in a world that's profoundly different. So when we take a look at some of Ron's insights that of the spirit of the age, the growth in atheism and no religion, and Numbers 1, 9, and 10 speak of this in some way. The Pew report that was done last year spoke of the ever-increasing number of individuals who identify themselves as none. In the last 5 years, that increased by 35%. People who have no identification to religion. As I mentioned, 75% of the kids that are going to Mass, and within 5 years are not going to Mass. As a side note, if you want to read a little bit more about that whole thing, there's a book called Sticky Faith. It's written by a married couple, Protestants, but their statistics are not just Protestant, but it's Protestant Catholics. And what they do is they raise the question, what that 25% of the kids that are continually going to church, what did the parents do? What happened that made that faith stick? Right, so they take a look at markers and elements about what makes the faith stick of that 25%. I won't get into that because it's not what we're about here. But it's an interesting study. One of the things, just for our discussion here, is one of the things that those 25% of the kids that are continually going to church is that they were raised in intergenerational ministry. Is that one of the things that we've done in the church, and we thought this was a really good idea, but I think we're coming back to say that maybe it's not, and that is that we created these little worlds of youth groups, which are important. It's important that they have their peers, but it's what I call, what developed is what I call chameleon Catholics, and that is they do what their peers are going to do. So if their peers are going to church, then they're going to go to church, but as soon as they go to college and their peers are no longer going to, then that's what they're going to do, right? So they just begin to take on the ways of, I would say, the ways of the world. Well, one of the things that was interesting about this, and I think it might have something to say for you who are trying to recruit more young people to be a part of your communities, and that is where young people experience intergenerational ministry, that the church didn't just look like them, right? Didn't look like their peers, but it looked like people who were older than them. And they actually engaged with them, they did ministry with them, they did work with them, and they were empowered to do work with people who were younger than them. Kids who had experiences such as that had a greater likelihood of being able to continue their faith after they graduated from high school, because it wasn't just this world, but they saw something that they could be, and they saw some people that they could influence as well. That's a side note. Amen?
Amen.
We hear a big word today, and it's spiritual, not religious. And a large population are referring themselves as spiritual and not religious. And what does that mean? It means it's a profound rejection of organized religion. It is a creation of a religion that allows them to do what they desire to do with nobody telling them no. We are not different than a 2-year-old. We're not different than Adam and Eve. We don't like to be told no. Right? So this idea of spiritual or religious, that's what it is it's a rejection of organized religion. It's a relationship with God that speaks to whatever they desire, that speaks to whatever they believe to be true, without boundaries. The joke is that God created us in his image and we return the favor. Another marker of this generation this culture today is a rejection of reason. I mean, just listen to people talk today, and it's all about, I feel, I feel, I feel. Even if that word doesn't make sense for what they're actually saying. But it's become dominant in no longer rationally thinking about situations, but reacting to situations, reacting to the culture merely by feeling. And we find this in all kinds of ways, that everybody is offended and outraged. And the number one sin in our world today is do not offend anybody. A side note, I think the gospel offends. There are some things about it that's going to offend, and yet in our desire not to offend anybody, because in our culture today, the number one sin is to not be nice. Right? To not be nice. And we can't offend anybody. When I was a kid, sticks and stones are great. I mean, not in the culture, not in the age today, right? Some of the other impacts and effects of the inability to reason is that this is a non-reflective age. We live in an age that is so busy, that is so consumed, that we don't take time to reflect and to stop and to be quiet. Ron speaks of these in his fifth and his sixth point. It's also an age that doesn't reflect on consequences. Do what you do and worry about consequences later, if at all. And again, the last part of this particular, the rejection of reason, is also loosely related. It's an extremely non-committal culture in the age that we live in. Always looking to see if something better is coming. So getting people to sign up, to help out. Everybody's schedule is already so busy, so many things that are going on. We find it more and more difficult to have people who will actually commit. So the average age of marriage is going up. People are living together more and more for fear of actually committing to something. And I think this has an impact on my vowed life, right? On our life together as Franciscans and getting people to actually commit to something. Again, building on the idea that they are non-reflective. We live in a world not just with young people, but with multiple screens in front of them at all times. Television, computers, tablets, Kindles, music, everything that we live in this world that is just constant coming at us. We live in a world that is a 24-hour news cycle that is continually back. I mean, to turn off the computer, to leave your phone in the room because you might miss something, to have the TV on in the background in case something happens. We are being bombarded 24 hours a day with noise. And because of this, the interior life is suffering. Again, Ron in points 5 and 6 speaks of this, an inability to be quiet. One of the things I thought that was beautiful that Pope Benedict was talking with the new evangelization, he said, if there's going to be a new evangelization, there also needs to be a new interiority. Is that we need to invite people to an interior life, which has been largely forgotten. On two levels. One, on a younger level, in the younger part of our culture that just is never quiet. And on the older part of the culture that while they may say their prayers, they're never quiet either. Right? They're never quiet. The idea of going to a cave outside of Assisi without anything and being still scares the crap out of people, right? Because we're afraid what we might hear. We live in a culture and an age that is consumed with self. We are in the middle of everything. Words like sacrifice, dying to self, self-emptying, kenosis, being stripped, are foreign to this age. Make no sense at all. I think one of the biggest spirit of the age, the way that our age has been infiltrated, and that is a profound rejection of truth. That we live in a world, again, in the pre-modern world, God was the source of truth. In the modern world, man. Today, there is no truth. Truth is whatever an individual believes to be true. And I would say, in relationship with that, that's what freedom is as well. Freedom is the ability to do whatever you want, whenever you want. Pope John Paul, when he was in St. Louis, he had, I think, just a beautiful quote when he was speaking about truth and about freedom. And he said, freedom is not the ability to do whatever we want, whenever we want. And if we think about this, we live in a world that we, in the name of freedom, right? In the name of freedom, we can do whatever we want. And it can have whatever impact on other people is, well, because I'm free and I ought to be able to do what I want. Pope John Paul would go on to say that when truth is separated from freedom, freedom is the ability to do whatever we want. Truth is the ability to believe whatever I want. When those two things are separated, he says, the very moral fabric of society begins to unravel. This was, Ken, when was the Holy Father? 70s?
99.
In 99, in St. Louis. Okay. In 99, almost 20 years ago. All right, we're seeing that. The very moral fabric of society, the very moral fabric of our culture is beginning to change. Where in the modern and the pre-modern world, there might have been something which is true, something which is good and beautiful, in moral society, in the world that we live in now, it is not merely an immoral. There used to be immorality, right? One of the friars tells a story that in 1970 or something like that, and a little guy who ran a little local hotel near Loretto called one of the friars, and he said, somebody's here, and he's saying that a young couple, they're saying since Vatican II, it's okay if you sleep together. Is that true? You know? So it's like, well, no, that's not true. It's like, okay, I just want to check. I mean, the days of that, right? The days of somebody calling a priest and asking a question like that in Loretto Hotel, those days are over, right? There used to be a world that we had a moral norm that could be offended, right? A moral norm that could be offended. Well, we live today in a culture that is amoral, that there is not a moral norm that can be offended. There is not, some things are right, but there is no moral norm that can be offended because we are the arbitrators of what is true. So we live in a world in a culture that says that we can do whatever we want to be able to do. And part of the great, great problem with this is that in the past, the church was seen as part of the solution, right? The church was seen as a place that we can land, a place of order, a place of, that is not in fact the case anymore. That we live in a culture and an age that the church is the problem, right? She used to be the solution. That we can look to the church for wisdom and guidance. Today she's seen as part of the problem. Today she's seen as the enemy of the spirit of the age. And then because of the world that we live in with the social media and the news and the media and all of this, it becomes even more highlighted. I don't know that it's necessarily terribly different than it's not. But we live with a young population that's never not known scandal. Kids are 20 years old today, they've never known the church without scandal. No. Every couple months, every year or two, something new, right? This has a great impact on culture and on the young people and on the world. I mean, I did a post for my website related to the most recent scandal, and one of the things I did is I apologized to those people that have to try to defend the church at the water cooler on Monday morning, right? That rather the church being seen as a place where people can go for answers and wisdom and knowledge and solace and all of this, it becomes part of the problem. So, because of this, because of no sense of truth, no sense of right, no sense of wrong, rather than looking to something or someone to give order, to give balance, to give, we look to one another. So we say, we're not as bad as, right? So rather than God being the source that I compare myself to, the person of Jesus that I compare myself to, we live in a world that we compare ourselves to. Well, I'm not that bad, therefore I'm not. Words like should and should not are foreign to this culture. Truth and preference are largely the same. And what this has done, and I think Ron speaks about this again in his document, it's created a world that is terribly disunited, that we can't have a discussion anymore without people being angry and I just started reading the book, and it's called The Art of Disagreeing. But we live in a world that just because, again, and this makes sense, right? If I'm the arbitrator of what's true, if I determine what's true, if somebody disagrees with me, well, that reflects on me. That if I hold a particular stance and you disagree with that stance, that's, you disagree with me, because it came forth from me, because I am the arbitrator, I'm the source of what is true. So what that has caused is, I think, a great inability for us to actually talk to each other. And what we're creating is we're creating worlds that look just like us, because we have no possibility of being able to dialogue with people who think differently than us. And there's no way we're going to build our Franciscan communities, our church, evangelization, this world of good with the gospel that you prayed at the beginning, if we're not able to talk and have conversations with people who think different than we do. And yet what we live in is a world that just because I think something differently, I'm a bad guy, or we're the bad guys, whatever that is, right or left, it's very liberal. And that's, I think, Ron speaks about that, is that the right and the left are dominating, that says we have to now be pigeonholed. One of the things I love about that Pope Francis said, it says if we tear down the walls, we see names and faces, right? We tear down the walls and we see names and faces, and we recognize and realize that they don't look that different than us, right? They may think something different, but they don't let their hopes and their dreams, their anxieties, they're not that different. And yet, we live in a world that's become so divided and so hostile that we can't have conversations and dialogue. The world, the word that dominates this age is tolerance. That we ought to tolerate everything. School district in Massachusetts, in their mission statement says, we will tolerate all things except what we believe to be intolerant. No, and the reality is who is perceived to be intolerant? The voice of truth, or of what we've traditionally understand it as right and wrong and good and bad. So what has all this led to? It's led to a world and a culture that is in the midst of chaos and despair. Why is suicide rates going through the roof? And not just of young people, right? Of older people that find themselves to be isolated and empty and not thinking their last years were going to be like this. We live in a world where, because of social media, people feel disenfranchised. They feel like they not have a voice. They feel like nobody listens, nobody sees, nobody recognizes. And there's nowhere to go. Thoughts, comments, questions? I mean, I'll keep going, but yeah.
I'm a veteran of Vietnam. I went to group therapy to put together veterans. And they get offended. I talk about my views. And if I'm those are the tools I used to survive, yet they are using the tools of drugs and being angry and so forth. You know? So you like what you're saying? We're talking about my age.
Absolutely. That we live in a world that is profoundly different. That when you, 50 years ago, they would have been celebrated. Today, they're ostracized. Right? And this impacts the way we evangelize. This impacts the way we do ministry. This impacts the way we dialogue. Words that mean one thing don't mean the same that they did to you. I mean, there's a population of culture that's using words like freedom that means something radically different than what this generation necessarily understands the word to be, or truth, things like that. So you're the bad guy because of those things. Absolutely, sure. And we need to be able to learn to live in that world. Interestingly, years ago, Richard Rohr did a series called Breathing Underwater. And this is a part of this, is that the world and the culture has become so dysfunctional, we need to learn how to operate in that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, somebody else. Yeah.
It may irritate, but then it
still hurts. No, it needs to be. Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. But these factors you're talking about, what's keeping people from volunteering to get the young people that work in the church or even some civic organizations?
Absolutely.
I teach as an adjunct at a university in Chicago, and it's. I just see so much of this in my students. They're all undergrads, and there's so much emphasis on this, yeah, my truth, your truth, what's true for you is not true for me. And I see them sort of being adrift, but there's nothing to really anchor.
Absolutely.
And that I teach at Catholic University, and most of the students don't even know that there is a chapel on campus, much less where it is. And one thing I try to tell them, I actually sneak in some John Paul a little bit into my class.
You're
and I'm really big on the idea of that true freedom is having the right to do what you want.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that this is and that the church is where that's where that anchors me in God's love to do what I ought. But the pushback that I often receive from them though is that even my saying that I am a Catholic in a Catholic university is seen by many as my forcing religion upon them. Mm-hmm. And I'm comfortable in the tension. I'm just not sure how to, move the conversation forward.
Yeah, no, I mean, again, it's hard to imagine that you are uncomfortable being Catholic in a Catholic university or Catholic in Ontario. I mean, this is the new normal, right? This is the world that we live in. Yeah. So that's what gives sense.
I see more and more of where the parents are being the switch of roles.
Absolutely.
The kids are the parents, and the kids tell the parents, Mom and Dad, I don't want to go to faith formation because I want to take vacation on the Legion. Mm-hmm. And the parent says, oh yes, you're really tired and you do a lot, so you don't have to go to faith formation. We will not register you. And there are parents that are committed to both. So I see more and more, it's a tendency.
Well, and I think that's one of the changes that we've seen in the culture and in the spirit of our age is that the family is dominated by the child rather than the parent. Like, if I would have told my parents I didn't feel like when they were through laughing, we would get me. But I would never have done that. Rather than. Yeah. In the spirit of age would say that's ridiculous. That this idea that this is how we do formation, we ought to bend to their desires. And I mean, we're seeing you, I'm sorry, I don't know your name on our college campus. I mean, it's the same thing. College kids, 18-year-old kids are dominating and controlling what's taking place. Who's the adult in this situation? And yet, the pushback is because we adults haven't done so great, right? You know, it's hard to say to these kids, it's like, well, you should go to church. And they're like, seriously? Have you read the newspaper or that? Why would I want to? Now, I think, and we're going to get to this is, in fact, an unbelievable opportunity to bring the gospel into the midst of that. But that's what's been lost in all this. Yeah.
Yeah, I can only speak for myself, but you spoke about the discomfort of being Catholic in a Catholic university. In a church, the children today don't know a church without scandal. There's a certain discomfort that I have being in the AMBO now, in the light of the scandals. So the discomfort goes up the chain.
No, yeah, walking through, I was actually, I traveled this weekend, this fall again. Walking through the airport, I always wear my clerics in the airport. I think it's important that I be recognized as a priest, but walking through this last couple weeks has been interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned how should it's
kind of bad words.
What we should do, but you know, should is what we ought, and ought is the basis for ethics. So whether it's moral ethics, social ethics or sexual ethics, what we ought to do is the right thing. So when we lose should, our ethics are gone.
Yeah, again, the Holy Father said, John Paul is in St. Louis, freedom, truth is not to believe or do whatever we want, but to do what we ought. And then he goes and takes us to the scripture. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Mm-hmm.
To that point, there seems to be no standard.
There is none. And that
the
is
standard
what,
keeps moving. It's wherever you want to stand.
That's what the word for this age, the spirit of this age, is chaos. It's chaos. But I will say, just as a preface to that, is that everything you just said is absolutely true. But the culture in the world that we live today, we need to be able to provide voice to that. You know, the idea, you know, live the gospel, we're not serious words. We all know that Francis didn't say that, that's okay. But it's time to use words. I mean, it's time for us to be able to articulate, and Paul said there, Paul VI stated this in Evento Etiam. He says that there is a power and a grace in a wordless witness, and yet we eventually need to be able to give words to that which gives us hope. And I think that's one of the areas, because it's such a toxic culture that we're afraid of putting words. I mean, people are losing their jobs because of things that they say. Mm-hmm. Right? So, all right, let's just a moment or two. We're going to take a little bit of a break, and we'll go from there. Okay, this is the spirit of the age that we live in, all right? How do we engage that culture? How do we see, okay, this, we're coming to a deeper understanding of again, what Paul would say, the spirit of the age, what Ron talks about, that the elements of the ecclesial age that we find ourselves, how do we engage this culture? Provide you three options. One is accommodation. Everything's okay. It's all right. We'll work through it. I don't want to offend anyone, so I'm not going to say anything. I don't want to make anyone bad. I don't want to rock the boat. We just kind of need to fit in. The problem with that is it affirms many of the fundamental beliefs of the spirit of the age. Not inviting people to conversion. Saying everything is okay, tolerating everything, ultimately doesn't respect the individual. While harsh, I was in a talk recently and I heard it, one of the speakers says, we are tolerating people to hell. But his point was in our desire not to offend or not to say or not to be harsh, we're letting behavior that if we believe is Christians, that's ultimately damaging to themselves in the desire not to bother or offend anybody. And I think parents are particularly experiencing this with kids, is we're not saying anything. The other is that there's no critique of culture. Nobody is pointing out what is good or bad. Nobody is being a light in the midst of darkness. Another way is isolation. We're going to pull back. We're going to separate ourselves from the dirty world. The world is foul, it's infected, it's polluted, so we're going to escape them. We're going to build these walls, and we'll live behind these walls with people that are like us, that think like us, that pray like us, that worship, all these kinds of things. So we're going to isolate ourselves from the world, which is so dirty. I don't want to be infected by that. Obviously, a critique of this, it's profoundly anti-Christian. The nature of the incarnation is a God who is willing to get dirty, about a God who is willing to enter the mess, who has allowed himself to be infected. I love the image of Francis standing up on the edge looking over the valley. He says, the world is going to be my cloister. I'm going to engage this world. I'm not going to run from it. I'm not going to hide from it. I'm not going to live behind walls. Rather, I'm going to engage this world. If no one confronts the culture, and Christianity is supposed to be countercultural, one of the things that I love that Pope Francis has stated is that the church was never supposed to be in the center and the source of power. And yet, over the centuries, that's what's become. She was never supposed to be there. She was always the church. When she was strong in the beginning, she was the church on the fringe. Church Christianity is supposed to be countercultural. We cannot withdraw from culture. We must confront it. I love what Martin Luther King said. He said, Christians are not to be thermostats of culture. No, they're not supposed to be thermometers of culture. Rather, they're supposed to be thermostats of culture. That they set the temperature of a culture. They don't just take the temperature, they set the temperature of a culture. It is imperative that we not pull back from the spirit of the age. Rather, that we embrace. So the third way possibility of engaging this culture is infiltration and transformation. Seek to engage the culture and to transform from within. And it seems to me that's what Christ did. It seems to me that that's what Francis did. Engagement is key. If we simply surround ourselves by people who think and act and believe exactly what we believe, there's nothing that's, the gospel is not going to be proclaimed. If we take seriously the prayer that you've done as you've come up to this meeting, the desire to create a fraternal world, a world that's imbued by the gospel, that takes place by your transformation and our being transformed and then going out to the world and helping bring forth transformation in that world. It seems to me that's exactly what Francis does with the lepers, right? He embraces them. He recognizes Christ, and we can't miss that, that he recognizes Christ. And that's what motivated Francis to now go back and live with the lepers. Because he found and he discovered Christ there. Not because they're lepers, but because Christ was there. We need to be able to help, first off, ourselves recognize and see that, and then help other people see the beauty that is in that. An author by the name of Dick Staub wrote a book called Too Christian, Too Pagan. And in this book, he talks about why people didn't like Jesus. Because the people that were holy didn't like him because he spent too much time with those who weren't. And those who weren't holy didn't like him because he spent all those times with the religious leaders. But he states in this book, he says there must be two conversions in the Christian. One is a conversion away from the world, away from the spirit of the age, to Christ. And the second conversion, and he would go on to say that most of us don't make the second conversion is back to the world with Christ. And I think we can see that in Francis. We see in the early times of his conversion, him getting away, him going to the caves, and spending the time and trying to figure out what it is that God was asking him to do. But once he has determined that, then he goes right back out into the world to bring to the world what he's discovered, to bring to the world who he has found. And that is our challenge. I think it's a challenge of us as individuals, as Franciscans, but also as people who are involved in formation. And that is to first allow ourselves to be transformed, and in that, other people will recognize that there's something different, as you stated, that people would look at you and they'd say, there's something different about you. Well, what we need to do is to be able to give a name to that. This is what's different. Peter says, always be prepared to give an account of that which gives you hope. Well, how is it that we're different? That's what we're going to talk about. Amen?
Amen.
Let's take a break for, I've got 10:03. Let's take a break until 10:15. Okay? 10:15, we'll be back.